I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Joe Berlinger has been making documentaries for almost two decades, along with his directing partner, Bruce Sanofsky. Their first film, Brother's Keeper, about a murder among brothers who were struggling dairy farmers in upstate New York, won the Sundance Film Festival in 1992. Their most recent film is also about murder. Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, is the third film in a series of documentaries about a crime that took place 18 years ago. Three 8-year-old boys were murdered in rural Arkansas, and three teenagers were charged with the crime, Damian Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miss Kelly. The prosecution painted the teens who wore black, listened to heavy metal, and read Stephen King novels as Satan worshippers participating in ritualistic killings. When Berlinger went down to investigate, he found very little physical evidence. What he did find was a modern-day witch hunt.
At a press conference, Inspector Gary Gitchell said the case against the accused teens is very strong.
Scale of 1 to 10, how solid do you think the case is?
11.
That's an excerpt from Berlinger's first film about the case. His films brought a lot of attention to what was happening in Arkansas. Just last August, after 18 years in prison, Eccles, Baldwin, and Ms. Kelly were released. This probably wouldn't have happened without Berlinger's films and support from celebrities like Johnny Depp, Eddie Vedder, and others who raised millions to fund appeals regarding DNA evidence. The fact that the three were ultimately released surprised no one more than Berlinger. When he first went down to Arkansas, he expected to find something very different.
We went down thinking we were going to be making a film about guilty teenagers because we didn't know at the time just how irresponsible the local press was in covering the story. And this was right around the time of the Jamie Bulger case in the UK, about a year and a half before that. A 10-year-old kid had lured a younger kid out into the railroad tracks in Liverpool and just beat him to death. And so we thought there was an emerging trend of youth violence. And so we went down thinking we were going to make a real-life River's Edge. And we got down there, and 1 + 1 was not equaling 2. You know,
when did that occur to you?
I can't say immediately because it took about 3 months to negotiate access into their holding cells prior to the trial. But once Bruce and I met Damian, and in particular, we just felt like this was not, you know, out of a 1 out of 10 in the film, he says it's an 11. It was like a -1.
And you started to base that thinking on conversations with the defendants themselves or evidence and discussions with their attorneys as well?
All of the above. You know, you look at Jason Baldwin, a 16-year-old scrawny kid with, you know, arms that are couldn't be capable of the crime that was committed. He just oozed credibility. Damian Eccles, I mean, even though he was his own worst enemy in some ways because he kind of enjoyed the attention and was, you know, a little narcissistic about the whole thing, it just didn't make sense, you know. And when you start looking at the forensic evidence, I mean, here you have allegedly a crime by three teens who are not professional killers who brought, according to the prosecutor, three little boys out into the woods and slaughtered them to death in this savage beating, and yet there was no blood found at the crime scene. And then you look at the confession, and the confession is riddled with inconsistencies and problems.
And so, coaching.
And coaching. So within months, we knew that something was amiss.
I found that Eccles came across as a very unsympathetic person at times, and as you mentioned the word narcissism, he never seemed to really suffer. Were there times that you were convinced that Eccles really was genuine, that he suffered off camera? You never really showed him. Not that I needed him to break down and cry. But.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, you know, because some people view Eccles that way, and some people view Eccles very differently, very sympathetically. I mean, a lot of people, you know, the amazing thing about this story.
I think he's ultimately sympathetic because he's innocent. But yeah. I mean, I'm just saying his demeanor as a character.
Yeah,
in film.
No, I mean, I think he didn't do himself any favors when he took the stand. You know,
In what way?
Well, I think he kind of enjoyed the attention, and as he explained to us in a subsequent film, you know, he just never imagined that he would be convicted for these rumors and ghost stories. He just believed that it would be made right. I mean, the interesting thing for me is just this worldwide explosion that these films created, and it was people both famous and not famous, regular people and people like Johnny Depp, who all said, like, you know what, that guy could be me. I dressed a little different. Yeah. I acted a little differently.
Yeah, I was the other.
I was the other. And in the right circumstances, I could have been that guy. And so I think he did evoke a lot of sympathetic feelings from people.
Now, at the culmination of this long two-decade process during which you made three films, these men walked out of prison for time served in exchange for copping this plea. What was
it? The state of Arkansas let them out under what's called an Alford plea. It's a rarely used legal maneuver. It's incredibly bizarre. It's disheartening that this was the resolution. You know, on the one hand, of course, we're all delighted these guys are out of prison.
But not exonerated.
But not exonerated. And that's the problem. The Alford plea is where you profess your innocence, but for legal purposes, you plead guilty to lesser charges. So the charges were reduced from capital murder, which is the death penalty or life without parole, to first-degree murder.
Right.
And because they had spent 18 years in prison,
they got time served.
They were sentenced to time served. Also, there's a suspended sentence hanging over their heads that if they ever violate a crime, they will have to serve more time for these murders.
Are you planning on a fourth movie?
People keep asking that. And, we made these three movies as acts of advocacy. A fourth movie feels like we would be kind of milking it, you know, and I'm not sure I want to go down that road.
I honestly don't agree with you.
Really?
To me, the last chapter of this is, what did wrongful conviction and wrongful incarceration do to them? Life for them freezes there as a young man and their body keeps aging, but you wonder what kind of development they have. Then you release them out into the world. And I mean, God knows the state of Arkansas had the least generous public defender approach toward this case. Was their counsel public defender at first?
Well, some of them were public defenders and some of them wanted to take the case on, but they did not get the kind of representation that you would expect. I mean, it's in fact one of the great tragedies and what people should focus on with this story is that it has taken 18 years, millions and millions of dollars provided by people like Peter Jackson and Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam and Johnny Depp.
Right.
Natalie Maines, three very relatively expensive documentaries from HBO. I mean, there's something wrong with our legal system where this is what it takes to get somebody out of prison, and why don't they have that kind of defense right from the get-go? You know, maybe there is a Paradise Lost 4 if we want to exonerate these guys, because the Alford plea, it's deeply disturbing. You have three guys who were wrongfully convicted, spent their entire adult life up till now in prison for a crime they didn't commit, and the state of Arkansas is making them plead guilty so that A, they won't be sued for wrongful conviction.
Exactly.
So they're not going to get any compensation.
Exactly.
And B, that means the state of Arkansas is not looking for the real killers.
I mean, the people of the state of Arkansas should be disgusted.
And what, you know, just how slowly the wheels of justice grind forward. The simplest things like this DNA action, you know, in 2001, Arkansas passed a DNA statute which allows you to go test new evidence. And they argued for several years whether they could even do the testing. And then the state wanted a particular crime lab. I mean, literally for 6 years it took to get these DNA results out. However, when it came time to craft this Alford plea, when they were fearing the HBO broadcast and when they were fearing this evidentiary hearing that was coming up in December, literally in 6 or 7 days, They banged out this Alford plea. So, you know, when it's in their interest, they can make it happen pretty damn quickly.
Why didn't you abandon it after the first film? What made you come back?
That's a great question. Both Bruce and I were just absolutely tortured at the idea these guys were still rotting in prison. And, you know, the case was 93, 94, but the movie didn't come out until 96. Those guys had been in prison already for 4 years. It just haunted us, you know. On the other hand, going back and revisiting, this is a depressing story. I feel like I lost like my fatherly innocence by covering this story. And what I mean by that is, you know, my first kid was born while we were editing this film. And I would be sitting, you know, at the editing bay looking at the most horrific autopsy photos and crime scene footage. You know, I would go home at night after having these images like emblazoned on your brain, and I would drop the door of the crib and pick up my new infant who has just arrived a few months ago, and holding my child and thinking about these 8-year-olds and thinking about the gross autopsy footage that I had looked at. I mean, it was just an emotionally draining experience making these films. And so it was a very considered decision to go back and to do it a second time and a third time. And, you know, during the second film, I had my second kid.
And your life's going on and theirs isn't.
I mean, it just tortured me. But every hallmark that my child would go through, you know, kindergarten, middle school, high school, I'd think, my God, these guys are still rotting in prison. I just felt we had a moral obligation to keep telling the story.
But was there ever a moment where you and your principal staff, your real cadre of people you did this film with, or even in your mind, you just raised a glass to each other and said, "We got these guys out of prison"?
Oh yeah, we did some pretty hard partying. We did some pretty hard partying in Toronto and really felt good about what we did.
You must feel amazing.
No, it's look, you know, we're filmmakers. We made films. We're paid to make films. We deserve some credit. The people who really deserve the credit are the tens of thousands of people, both regular and the Johnny Depps, who have given us, you know, big sums of money or little sums of money, who selflessly have advocated for decades for their release. Lori Davis knew nothing about this crime or this case, saw the movie, and she was living in Brooklyn as an architect. Just couldn't get it out of her mind, started writing to Damien, went to visit Damien, fell in love, married him. And, you know, they've been married for 14 years. Most of that time, obviously, he's been on death row, and she has been a tireless advocate for his release. I mean, she's a big reason he's out of prison.
That must be so bizarre. I can't imagine.
Yeah, I can't imagine either, because they really, you know, look, she's a wonderful person. It's just one of those bizarre things you could never, like, you know, script.
I'm Alec Baldwin. More from my conversation with Joe Berlinger is coming up in a minute. You're listening to Here's the Thing. You had said there's a quote I had from you where you said there's a fine line between being a storyteller and being a manipulator. Where in this film or in any of the three films involved with this did you feel that you had did a little manipulation?
I believe the audience should be treated like a jury. You give them the information and you weigh both sides and you let them come to their own conclusion. But with each passing film, we felt like we were moving away from pure storytelling and more into advocacy. And we certainly wanted to get people riled up about this. So, you know, I'm not sure we are manipulating people, but we clearly have a point of view that there is a huge injustice that needed to be, you know, it's interesting. The first film, you know, a good 20% of the people who walked away from the original film thought that they were guilty. And we let both sides have their say. And I think there's just been a progression towards, you know, more overt advocacy, which is kind of in conflict with my overall filmmaking philosophy, which is to treat the audience member like a jury member and let them make the decision about the events they're seeing.
Now, where did all your career begin? You were in advertising originally?
I had a brief stint at the very beginning of my career working in advertising, and actually I was a language major in college and spoke fluent German, but I worked in the Frankfurt, Germany office of Ogilvy & Mather. That's when I got the film bug, you know, because I started producing.
Why?
I started producing television commercials there, and the first time I walked on a film set and saw cameras and lights and action, I was like, oh, this is kind of cool.
And then what happened?
And so I came back to New York with Ogilvy and was on an American Express campaign as a producer, and we hired these guys called the Maisel Brothers, who did Gimme Shelter and Grey Gardens. And we hired them to do some television commercials, to do some unscripted documentary-style TV commercials. And David Maisel.
Who were they for? Amex?
For American Express.
And what were those commercials like?
It's actually a campaign that I think ended up not airing. It was kind of an experiment.
I'll bet.
But no, they did a lot of commercials, actually. Kind of documentary style. Anyway, I kind of hit it off with David Maisel. He's the brother who passed away quite a few years ago.
Right.
They were looking for somebody to market their services to Madison Avenue, and I was looking to get into the film business, and now I was a guy who had a couple of years of Madison Avenue. And so just over lunch, we kind of cooked up the idea, okay, let me come work for you. I'll get you more commercial business.
And did you?
And I got them a lot of commercial
business.
How
long were you with them?
Did that for about 5 years. So I was a couple.
What did you learn from them?
the act of faith of making a film about real life as it's unfolding, which sounds like, well, what's the big deal? But, you know, I mean, the idea of capturing human drama in all its ambiguous glory as it unfolds before the camera is, first of all, an incredible way to make a film. And secondly, to have faith. And I think we take that cinema verite movement a little bit for granted today.
I think people are better actors today than they ever were 40 years ago. This is where reality shows are awful because they are not unscripted. It's like, right. It's like the staged predation in nature documentaries. They get these people all wound up and then they throw them in the room together. Mm. But where you can get unvarnished and real verite insights into people, it's often only, I find, where those stakes are that high, like in a courtroom.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's the last Serengeti, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's you know, our dirty little secret. No coincidence that many of the films I've worked on are about legal cases. You know, the first big feature doc that Bruce and I did was Brothers Keeper.
But tell people about Brothers Keeper.
Brothers Keeper was the story of four brothers who lived in a shack and lived in a way that people might have lived like 200 years ago, no running water, and a little more eccentric than how people might have lived 200 years ago.
Where were they located?
Central New York State. And we had, you know, read in the New York Times that this guy had been arrested for this murder. He allegedly, you know, suffocated his bedmate brother, another, you know, these guys were in their late 60s, and the state police had gotten a confession out of him. The local community, however, felt he was innocent, that he was semi-literate, semi-retarded. And this incredible display, this old-fashioned Americana display of support ensued.
So the local equivalent of Eddie Vedder and Natalie Maines.
Exactly.
What's amazing, obviously, the polarity of it. I mean, I'd love you to comment on this, yeah. Where you've witnessed the worst of self-aggrandizing and self-serving human behavior, especially from public officials.
Yeah.
And then you've seen the best of people coming to the aid of their fellow men.
I mean, I used those words exactly, you know, when I was talking about this film up in Toronto where the film premiered. I have seen not just the dichotomy between Brothers Keeper and Paradise Lost, where in Brothers Keeper, the town assumed the best of their citizens and came to their defense. In Paradise Lost, they assumed the worst and, you know, it became a witch hunt.
So when you look at your biography, Brothers Keeper and three versions of Paradise Lost and other documentary films you've done are peppered in between a lot of other disparate kind of work you've done in television with Oprah Winfrey specials and Iconoclasts for
Sundance Channel. Sundance. We love Iconoclasts.
And Blair Witch 2, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's something we'd like to forget about Blair Witch 2.
Well, tell us about Blair Witch 2.
Well, my whole idea was to make fun of the whole idea.
Right.
And everyone was excited about the movie. We thought it was funny and scary and clever. And literally at the 12th hour, a new marketing person was hired. They, you know, decided that the movie needed to be scarier and to have, you know, more blood. And even though the whole point of the scares in the original Blair Witch was that there were no...
It was all psychological.
It was all psychological. And I kept saying, why do you want to show these things? And so they literally recut the movie and reshot some pieces and... The movie that was released bears very little resemblance to the movie I shot.
That's incredible.
And that's been my one and only experience making a Hollywood movie. And I guess you could say that's why I make documentaries. I'd love another opportunity to do a feature at some point. But, you know, I'm just used to being the author of my own work, being totally in control. You know, obviously you have people you report to and people you collaborate with.
We're all working for somebody.
You know, but... You know, I just find the creative freedom of what I do, and I mix it up. You know, I do TV commercials and television series.
So that's how you do the one for them, one for me kind of switch.
Commercials.
Now, commercials.
Yes, commercials. My bread and butter are TV commercials and kind of web content, and I always have a few things cooking.
Some commercials.
A couple of TV shows.
Got to pay the bills, another trial for 9 years.
Exactly. My daughter, my daughter's going to college next year, so I gotta start paying for that. So
you're like Atticus Finch with a camera
exactly.
And a lab set.
Oh, I like that. Can I use that?
No, don't. Because then you're going to have to set up an 800 number for all your requests for people. Talking with Joe Berlinger about his film Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio. Let me know what you think. Email me at heresthething.org.